much.
You're welcome, Ellen. Thank you.
You can listen to this episode and more episodes of Health Watch online at kboo.org/healthwatch.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KBOO at the Clinton. This month, we'll screen the film tomorrow on Thursday, July 13th at 7 p.m. The documentary Tomorrow sets out to showcase alternative and creative ways of viewing agriculture, economics, energy, and education. It offers constructive solutions to act on a local level to make a difference on a global level. Instead of showing all the worst that can happen, this documentary focuses on the people suggesting solutions and their actions. Again, that's a film screening of the documentary Tomorrow, Thursday, July 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm. on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to Intersections Radio, the podcast where we geek out on all things intersectionality. I'm your host, Sarika Mehta. Welcome and thanks for tuning in. Today, my guest is Sandhya Menon. She's the author of the young adult teen romance, When Dimple Met Rishi, and this is her debut novel. When Dimple Met Rishi is the quintessential romance story, with the exception that it's from the rare perspective, at least in young adult literature, of South Asian American teenagers. Dimple and Rishi are both Indian Americans from the San Francisco Bay Area in the summer before going off to college, and they meet at a summer program called InsomniaCon. Oh, and by the way, their parents were fixing their marriage, and only one of them is actually aware of this. So there's a lot of fun twists and turns in this story. Sandhya Menon joins me by phone from Colorado, and this is Intersections Radio. Sandhya Menon, welcome to Intersections Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk about you a little bit first. The first part of your life, you grew up in Bombay on, quote, a healthy diet of Bollywood movies, and you moved to the U.S. when you were 15. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. I am an immigrant myself, so yeah, I've been here about 20 years now.
That must have been a difficult age or a tricky age to make this huge transition.
It was. It was a very tricky age. And I was, you know, like a lot of teenagers, extremely self-confident. And I thought about things that I had no right being self-confident in, I should say. Like, I thought, well, I've watched so much American TV that I know exactly what it's going to be like. And so I moved to South Carolina. And as soon as I arrived, I was like, okay, what is that accent? That is not an American accent. I don't understand anything anybody's saying to me. And yeah, it was a bit of a rude awakening, but in the end, it was really good for me because it forced me to grow up and it forced me to broaden my horizons and realize that I still had a lot to learn. And no, I didn't learn it all through TV. And so in the end, it all worked out and it was a great experience. Yeah.
I'm just thinking, you know, it's hard enough just to be a teenager, for one thing, a teenager while navigating a culture or two cultures, even if you were born and brought up here. And so just to cross hemispheres and start over, that must have been a lot at once.
Yeah, it was a lot. And you know, like you said, it was 20 years ago. So people weren't exactly as, I guess, how would I say, open-minded, but more educated about, you know, immigrants and different cultures. So it was challenging because there were definitely people who had never interacted with an immigrant before, and people who thought that if you had an accent, that meant you didn't understand the language or that you didn't speak the language. And, you know, English was my first language before anything else, so I had no problems understanding or speaking it, but it was in the perception of things, and that was really tough for me because I'd always written, and then all of a sudden I had an English teacher who was giving me D's because I was spelling things the British way and phrasing things in a more Indian way. So that was really tough as a kid. I was like, oh my gosh, you know, am I really don't know the language, like what's going on? And that was just part of it. And of course the religion thing was tough because people would bully me and then teachers wouldn't step in because they didn't know what to say or do. And so, yeah, it was a little rough, but at the same time, I think that it helped me to have friends who either had similar backgrounds or were sympathetic to my situation, and it helped me see that there are always people that you can turn to and who are willing to be your support system.
What really caught my attention was the differences in English and how you were graded down for it rather than it being considered this is a different dialect, this is a different way of communicating, and instead of it being something interesting and that this is your first language, you were reprimanded for it, basically.
Right, right. Yeah, and it was tough. And I remember I wanted to do the school newspapers, and I floated a bunch of ideas, and the teacher in charge only wanted me to write about my immigration experience rather than any other stories that I wanted to cover, like all the other kids. So I was that pigeonholed into this kind of role. And yeah, there's certainly a lot of very educated, forward-thinking people in South Carolina, but I also think that I wonder if part of it was that it was the South and some people hadn't been exposed to so much cultures, maybe in other parts of the country.
Fast forwarding a bit, despite all the struggles with English teachers and newspaper teachers, you are a professional writer. And I was going to say that this is the first time I've read a teen romance novel, and I really enjoyed it. What is it about this genre that you enjoy writing about?
I just love young adult literature in general. Like, I never subscribe to the fact that because it's young adult, baser literature doesn't have as much to teach as literary fiction and things like that. So I always read voraciously in the genre, and I think there's something about writing about adolescence that appeals not just to adolescents, but also to grown-ups, because that's kind of like the time when you step through that doorway between like the innocent oblivion of childhood into more adult matters. And we start to see the world in a different way, and we realize people relate to us in a different way based on who we are and where we come from. Mm-hmm. And I just find all those things extremely fascinating. And I think it can be fun and hopeful, and it can still be deep, and it can still teach things. So I think that's what I love about the genre.
It is the fun part of reading young adult literature. So as I've mentioned before, this is the first time I've read a romance novel, a teen romance, or any romance novel, I should say. And then at the same time, I'm also Gujarati, so I'm seeing Gujarati characters in a new genre that I've never read before, and that was really fun for me.
It never ceases to amaze me how much impact it has to see yourself where you've never seen yourself before. Like, mm-hmm. You might not even realize that you were missing from this whole life of publishing, but once you see yourself there, you're like, oh my God, this is just so amazing.
Exactly that. It leads me to my next point that, you know, I was just thinking that, you know, Bollywood as a movie industry is so prolific. And I know that in your bio, you joke about how much you enjoy Bollywood movies. But as far as I am aware, at least in this country, South Asian American romance writers are very, very few, despite the fact that Bollywood is so prolific. I mean, worldwide, not just in India. And why do you think there are so few South Asian American romance writers?
I'm not sure, you know, and I think obviously it started because people were saying, well, nobody wants to read about, you know, South Asians falling in love. We want to read South Asians like living in the slums and overcoming poverty or becoming doctors or, you know, getting married in horrible arranged marriages. I think that's probably how it started. And then I think it just continued that way. So I think that a lot of people want to read about South Asians in these issue books, you know, where they can learn more about the third world countries and the problems there. And so that's kind of where we were relegated to that space, and we were given the multicultural fiction label. And that's probably how it started. But I think then it became this big barrier. And to prove that people would want to read about South Asians who weren't South Asian, you know, like your average white reader who walks into the bookstore would still want to pick up a book about a South Asian character. I think that's like a huge mental block that they have to overcome. I know for me with Simon & Schuster, I got extremely lucky because the whole entire team was sort of on board. My editor was the one who actually brought up the idea of, hey, let's do this diverse title, but like in a light rom-com contemporary kind of way. And she's very passionate, and she was able to convince her team, and they were totally on board, which is really rare from what I understand. And of course, you can see that kind of in what's published too. So I think there's a whole thing of, you know, things coming together to kind of keep that South Asian romance out of bookstores. But I'm very hopeful that that's changing.
Yeah, I hope so too. I mean, there just should be more diversity across all of the genres. I'm glad you had a good experience in the publishing world. What are some of the challenges you encounter in writing and publishing in this genre?
So I think that in general, you know, if you write young adult, and you especially write young adult romance, and you're a woman, people tend to be more dismissive of you as an author and as a creator than if you were writing, say, literary fiction, or if you're a man, or whatever. And so I've definitely come across some condescension about, oh, well, you know, it's a rom-com, it's so fluffy, and it's not really, you know, highbrow literature, you're no Arundhati Roy, that kind of thing. but I'm prepared for that, and, you know, I was okay with that, because I embrace the fact that I like to write light and fluffy things, because I like to read them, too. But then also on the other side, I've gotten the question a lot, like, well, I'm not Indian, you know, will I be able to read your book? And the underlying question is, will I have anything to relate to in your book because you're brown, you know? And so that's not something that a lot of white writers get, like, will I be able to relate to your book if I'm not white? So I think that's something that a lot of minority or marginalized writers probably have to deal with. And I try to keep things upbeat. I never shame people for asking me that. And I say, oh, it's got Indian American teens and it deals with the culture, but it also is about people who feel like their families don't understand them, or people who really want to, you know, follow their ambitions, or people who fall in love, which a lot of people can relate to. So that's kind of how I handle those kinds of things.
Yeah, if you get that question time and time again, I commend you for not just shutting it down with, do you ask white people this question?
Yeah, it's tough sometimes.
Well, let's talk about the book. Dimple Shah and Rishi Patel are basically diametrically opposite characters who come from seemingly similar families, at least in the little that we know about their families. And I have to admit that there were a couple of things about the premise that I found a little bit incredulous, which may be a part of the genre. Some things like the fact that their parents were trying to fix their marriage and the kids are only 18. Especially, you know, like the Rishi Patel's character, I could see it just based on the qualities of what he values and what his family seems to value. But with Dimple Shah's character, more likely her parents would be like, yeah, you're on your own. We are not messing. We're not even going to bother.
Right.
Did you feel like that was maybe a young age to start at?
Oh, yeah. So totally. That was something that I was definitely kind of wondering, how am I going to make this work? Because we knew, so this whole book came about in sort of a conversation with my editor, and we were both really excited about the idea of an arranged marriage. But we wanted to set it in YA. So there's only so much room in YA. So we, of course, went as old as we could, which was 18. And I was like, you know, most parents, even the youngest kind of age that I see now in middle-class India, would be like 25 for an arranged marriage. And so that's kind of why I decided... I mentioned it a few times in the book, but it was like, right now we're just trying to see if you guys were compatible for each other. And, you know, marriage can wait for a while, but we wanted to, like, set things rolling. So that's kind of what we went with. And I think with YA, sometimes you have to take liberties with age, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's definitely what I did. I don't think that in real life that you would see too many people. Although, I should not say that, because I have a cousin whose marriage was arranged when she was 20, so not much older. But generally speaking, yeah, you wouldn't see people trying to arrange their kids' marriage when they're 18, But that's kind of what I did with that was like, oh, well, the marriage is going to come later.
Yeah, like arranged dating. But it was still like, they're only 18. Well, anyways. And then the other thing that I found surprising was, you know, again, with the Dimple Shaw character, I think most of the story is written from her perspective. She gets admittance to Stanford, and then she gets accepted into this Insomniacon, which I assume is something like hackathon. And I was kind of surprised by her parents, or mostly her mother, being a little blasé about it, just because it kind of feels that regardless of how conservative or traditional parents might be, they would be thrilled at this kind of news, and especially just this young woman of color who's getting some pretty outstanding opportunities.
I would disagree there because I think it just depends on your family and your background and your experiences, but I am definitely in a family where girls' accomplishments are not celebrated in that way. And so I have experienced firsthand many times people getting accepted into Ivy League universities or their counterparts in India and parents just being like, okay, good. That's good for like the matrimonial section that we'll be writing later, you know? So that's kind of what I wanted to address was I feel like there are so many middle-class families that function like that. And it can be really disappointing when you have a very ambitious girl in the family who's doing all this stuff, not just because she wants to get married, but because she actually believes in herself. You know? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what I was trying to show with that.
That definitely came through, and you do make a good point that a lot of the successes of women are kind of to be put on a, you know, accolades for matrimonial purposes. That is a good point.
Right. Yeah. It's so aggravating.
Oh, yes. That is, yes. And this is a fun read, you know, despite these institutional problems that we have in our society. This is still a very fun read with the romance and the comedy, and again, with Dimple Shaw. Like you were just saying, she really believes in herself and she's pretty hell-bent on making this career for herself. But at moments when she and Rishi are exploring their relationship, I don't know if I'm giving a spoiler here, but she throws caution to the wind. What I really appreciated about that was it was not as a rebellion against her culture or her parents. It was kind of a little bit of a rebellion against herself. And I appreciated that little dynamic.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, that was very interesting for me to write because I felt like it was imperative to show like her as a fully, you know, fleshed out three-dimensional character. A lot of times we have these little contradictions within ourselves, and especially when you're 18 and it's your first time like out of the house, you know, I wanted to explore all these different facets of myself, and some of them were very contradictory, but I think that's just part of adolescence and like finding out who you really are and what matters.
And like you said, the fact that we do have contradictory aspects of ourselves, every human does.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about a different side of the book. You have this set in this contest called Insomniacon. Talk about the research you did to write this, not just the cultural component in writing the characters, but like I said, the setting.
Yeah, so the setting was kind of interesting because I always wanted to base a book in California. And so when my editor and I were talking, she was like, oh, the Dimple being so techie, maybe like California makes more sense because there's like Silicon Valley and all that stuff. And I was like, oh, that's actually a really good idea. And that gives me a chance to kind of do a lot of research because at the time that I wrote it, I had never been to California at all.
Oh, wow.
So I went. Most of my research for the Bay Area was done via YouTube, where people actually, I found out, carry cameras around the city, so you can see the city from their point of view, and they just drive or walk around all these different places and show you what they're seeing and talk a little bit about what they're seeing. And then there are also forums that you can go on where people talk in detail about where they live or which restaurants are good or what they don't like about the city or what they love about the city, and weird things like crawl the fog.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it was all long distance research. I'd never actually been there. And then after the book came out, I actually got to do a little tour there.
So did you hit up the spots where Dimple and Rishi went when you finally did make it to California?
I did. So sadly, like 2 days before I got there, my readers reached out and told me that book bar that I write about closed. So I was very sad. Yeah, I know. I really wanted to go there, so I was really sad. But I did go to Bernal Heights, which is mentioned in the book. It was amazing. I took a little video and posted it on Instagram, and yeah, I had a blast.
Yeah, some of those sites are pretty outstanding. I didn't realize that you had never been to California until you were on your tour.
I know. It's crazy. And I'm glad, because a lot of people say, I had no idea. I couldn't tell that you hadn't been to the area. So I would take that as a huge compliment.
Yeah. That's just about all the questions that I have. Do you have any other remarks that you want to share, or is that your next project?
Yeah. So my next YA contemporary is coming out summer 2018, and it's called From Twinkle with Love, and it's about an American aspiring teen filmmaker, and she writes letters in her diary to her favorite female filmmakers and kind of figures out, you know, romance stuff and friendship stuff and her own ambitions like that. And so it's super fun. It's like epistolary format. Hopefully the cover will be coming out in the next couple of months.
Okay, well then we will look forward to that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, Sandhya Menon, thank you so much for joining me on Intersections Radio.
Thank you for having me. It was really fun to talk to you.
That was my guest, Sandhya Menon, author of When Dimple Met Rishi. In case you missed it, last year, on April 19th of 2016, the Supreme Court of the United States had sworn in 13 deaf and hard of hearing lawyers, 12 of whom were present for the event itself. It was the first time that not only such a sizable minority was recognized in this manner, but it was also the first time the Supreme Court accommodated their regulations on access and devices for the purpose of serving these deaf lawyers. Last year, almost to the day, I spoke with New York-based deaf lawyer Anat Maital about her experience as one of these 13 sworn in at the Supreme Court. That same summer, I interviewed Zainab Al-Kebsi, a deaf lawyer based out of Washington, D.C. I wanted to air this interview now to pay homage to the momentous event of inclusion, accessibility, and recognition of civil rights. Zainab Al-Kebsi is the policy counsel for the National Association of the Deaf, which is a national civil rights organization run by and for deaf and hard of hearing people in the United States. This interview was originally recorded in American Sign Language with voiceover by Geraldine Asu. Again, this interview took place last year, so you might notice a shift in mood. This is Intersections Radio. Tell us a bit about yourself for our listeners and viewers.
My name is Zainab Al-Kebsi, and I'm Policy Counsel for National Association of the Deaf.
How long have you been practicing law, and what is your specialty?
I've been practicing law for 4 years. My specialty is regulatory affairs, which means I identify policy gaps at the federal level and advocate with federal agencies to address these regulatory gaps.
Tell us about your experiences as a practicing lawyer and law school. For example, what was the experience like for applying to law school and taking the LSATs? Was it a struggle to get accommodations you were legally entitled to?
I was fortunate, since I didn't struggle to get my requested accommodations that I'm legally entitled to, thanks to knowledgeable staffers and my self-advocacy. But others aren't always as fortunate. That's why it's important not to be complacent and to always advocate for what we need to pave the way for others. I decided to become a lawyer because of the obstacles I faced growing up deaf and a desire to break down those barriers for everyone.
What kinds of experiences and treatment have you received both in practice and in law school?
It was a little isolating being a deaf student surrounded by hearing students and navigating the hearing world in the law school. Communication was a struggle, but my professors were always welcoming and accommodating. They treated me just like any other student and always held me up to the same ability standards as my hearing law student peers. I never wanted anyone to doubt that I couldn't do this just because I was deaf. So I studied hard and got good grades to prove that deaf people can succeed in law school and in the legal field.
What helped you most in getting through law school and taking the bar exam?
Studying hard. There's a lot of material to read through and analyze, so it's important to keep up with it to properly absorb all the information. Discipline, being goal-oriented, having a support system, that's vital. Not just my family, but other deaf lawyers to whom you can ask burning questions. They have been more than supportive. To this day, I still get together with other deaf lawyers to share war stories. We share a common experience, and that's a bond that's been vital for my success.
Now, as a deaf lawyer, not a client, but as a deaf lawyer, how are accommodations made for you in meetings, depositions at the court, and other such things?
I'm not a courtroom lawyer, but for meetings, I always request that ASL interpreters be provided. I have a recommendation list of top-notch lawyers that are knowledgeable about the legal jargon that I'm using, because I hate being at the mercy of random interpreters. It's the worst thing to have an interpreter that doesn't understand the content and makes you sound incompetent. So it's really key to have top-notch interpreters, and the people who handle the accommodation requests work with me on that.
Obviously, there is a small contingency of deaf lawyers in the United States. Do you feel supported as one of those deaf lawyers?
As I mentioned earlier, we have a core group of deaf lawyers that stay in touch with each other and provide support for each other. They have made a difference in my life.
I have to ask, have you faced any microaggressions or explicit discrimination toward you as a deaf woman of color?
Wow, that's a great question. I am deaf, a woman, a person of color, an Arab American, and a Muslim. I'm in the minority across the board, outnumbered. I have experienced discrimination for being part of each group and sometimes for being the whole package that I am, and it hasn't been easy. Such attitudes come from ignorance, and the best thing I can do is be a shining example of each category to prove them wrong. I would not change who I am for the world, and look at me now.
All right, let's talk about the momentous event at the Supreme Court. The swearing in at the Supreme Court. From what I understand, the Supreme Court is extremely closed in, does not allow for ease of accommodations or devices. What changed this time and why?
Our self-advocacy. We explained that we needed CART and ASL interpreters. We explained why such accommodations were needed and provided supporting materials. We did not give up when they first said no to our request. We kept at it until they agreed to it, the right answer. It was wonderful, since not only did it allow us full access to what was being said, it also allowed for heightened visibility to everyone else that, oh wow, 13 deaf and hard of hearing attorneys are being sworn in. It's highlighted the historic meaning behind the event.
Why do you think visibility is so important? What kind of cultural messages do you want to send out to society in general, but also to deaf communities in particular?
It showed that deaf and hard of hearing people can break through barriers. We can be anything we want to be. Lawyers, judges, doctors, nurses, engineers, president, what have you. It's important to have deaf role models for deaf youth in the community. People they can look up to in order to realize, I can do that too.
Something I noticed was that most of the group that was sworn in were women, and a significant portion were women of color. Now, how does this compare with other SCOTUS lawyers?
I noticed that right away as well, and it was incredible. Most of the SCOTUS courtroom was comprised of white men, so it really highlighted how much we have overcome to be where we are today.
Let's talk about your experience. How did you feel being sworn in and experiencing this recognition?
It was an incredible feeling. It was a day I will never forget. It was amazing to be part of such a historic moment. I especially had goosebumps when Chief Justice Roberts signed to us from the bench in quite a historic moment. I didn't expect it and immediately smiled at him. That visible moment highlighted recognition of our culture, our community, our language. It was beautiful and truly special.
Currently, the Supreme Court Courtroom Reporter provides transcripts of oral arguments on their website the same day an argument is heard by the court. What improvements would you like to see in terms of accessibility and visibility of the court's activities?
I'd like to see consistent provision of ASL interpreters in CART, not just for historic moments like these, but also in the day-to-day of SCOTUS proceedings. It's key for equal, full access to what's occurring inside the courtroom. As you mentioned, they already provide same-day transcripts, which is generated from real-time captioning. All they'd have to do is allow simultaneous access to this real-time captioning for deaf and hard-of-hearing people who are there. And the provision of ASL interpreters would allow for full equal access to what's being said in real time in the courtroom. equal access to the same information that hearing people get. It's as simple as that.
That's just about everything I have. Are there any other remarks or comments that you want to share with our viewers and listeners?
Thank you so much for highlighting this momentous event on your radio show and for your interest in the meaning behind all of this. Thank you. I hope we have shown others that anything is possible. Thanks.
That was Zainab Alkebsi, Policy Counsel for the National Association of the Deaf. This interview took place last year and was originally recorded in American Sign Language with voiceover by Geraldine Asu. To listen to the podcast of this interview, or read the transcript, or even watch the sign language video, check out intersectionsradio.wordpress.com. Visit the same website for previous episodes of this podcast, and join the Facebook community at facebook.com/intersectionsradio. You're listening to Intersections Radio. I'm Sarika Mehta. Thanks for listening.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house providing offering locally roasted coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or Facebook.com/Grendel's Coffeehouse.
Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
Stand by for the noontime jamboree.
Come on, come on, come on, come on.